But Fort Atkinson was a straight shot now, 500 miles down the Platte. They would more than make up the time on the boats, floating all the way, 25 miles a day. They could be there in 3 weeks if the weather held. Fitzgerald must have passed through Fort Atkinson, thought Glass. Glass pictured him, sauntering into the fort with the Anstalt. What lies had he invented to explain his presence? One thing was certain. Fitzgerald would not go unnoticed. Not many white men coming down the Missouri in winter. Glass pictured Fitzgerald's fishhook scar. Man like that makes an impression. With the confidence of a relentless predator, Glass knew that his quarry lay somewhere before him, nearer and nearer with each passing hour. Glass would find Fitzgerald, because he would never rest until he did. Glass planted his long pole against the bottom of the Platte and pushed.
25. March 28, 1824. The Platte carried Glass and his companions steadily downstream. For 2 days, the river flowed due east along the Buckskin foothills of low mountains. On the third day, the river took a sharp turn south. A snow-capped peak rose above the others like a head on broad shoulders. For a while, it seemed like they were headed straight toward the peak, until the Platte veered again, settling finally on a southeastern course. They made good time. Occasional headwinds slowed their progress, but more common was a stiff western breeze at their tail. Their supply of buffalo jerky eliminated the need to hunt. When they camped, the upside-down bull boats made good shelter. It took an hour every morning to re-caulk the bull boat seams with the supply they'd carried with them. But otherwise, they could spend almost every daylight hour on the water, drifting toward Fort Atkinson with minimal exertion. Glass was grateful to let the river do their work. It was the morning of the fifth day on the boats. Glass was spreading caulk when Red came tumbling back into camp.
"There's an Indian over the rise, a brave on a horse."
"Did he see you?"
Red shook his head vigorously. "Don't think so. There's a creek. Looked like he was checking a trap line."
"You make out the tribe?"
asked Glass.
"Look like a ring."
"Shit," said Chapman. "What are Rees doing on the Platte?" Glass questioned the reliability of Red's report. He doubted Arikara would wander this far from the Missouri. More likely, Red had seen a Cheyenne or a Pawnee.
"Let's go take a look."
For Red's benefit, he added,
"Nobody shoots unless I do."
They moved forward on hands and knees as they approached the crest of the butte, their rifles in the crooks of their arms. The snow had long since melted, so they picked their way through clumps of sage and dry stalks of buffalo grass. From the top of the hill, they saw the rider, or rather his back, as he rode down the Platte at a distance of a half mile. They could barely make out the horse, a piebald. There was no way to know his tribe, only that Indians were close.
"Now what do we do?" asked Red. "He ain't alone, and you know they must be camped on the river."
Glass shot an irritated glance at Red, who had an uncanny knack for spotting problems and an utter inability for crafting solutions. That said, he was probably right. The few creeks they'd passed had been small. Any Indians in the area would hug tight to the Platte, directly in their path.
"But what choice do we have?"
"Not much we can do," said Glass. "We'll put someone up on the bank to scout when we hit an open stretch."
Red started to mutter something, and Glass cut him off.
"I can pull my own boat. You men are free to go where you want, but I intend to float down this river."
He turned and walked back toward the bull boats. Chapman and Red took a long look at the fading rider, then turned to follow Glass. After 2 more good days in the boats, Glass guessed they had covered 150 miles. It was nearly dusk when they approached a tricky bend in the Platte. Glass thought about stopping for the night, waiting to navigate the stretch in better light, but there was no good spot to put ashore.
Bookend hills forced the river to narrow, which deepened the water and sped the current. On the north bank, a cottonwood had fallen partway across the river, trapping a wild tangle of debris behind it. Glass's boat led the other by 10 yards. The current carried him straight toward the downed tree. He sunk his pole to steer around. No bottom. The current accelerated, and the protruding branches of the cottonwood appeared suddenly like spears. One good poke, and the bull boat would sink. Glass raised himself on one knee and braced the other foot against the boat's ribbing. He lifted his pole and searched for a place to plant it. He saw a flat surface on the trunk and thrust his pole forward. The pole caught. Glass used all his strength to heave the clumsy craft against the current. He heard the rush of water against the boat as the current lifted its backside, pivoting the craft around the tree. Glass faced backward now, giving him a direct view of Red and Chapman. Both braced for impact, rocking the boat precariously. When Red raised his pole, he nearly bashed Chapman in the face. "Watch out, you idiot!" Chapman pushed his pole against the cottonwood as the current pressed hard from behind. Red finally extricated his pole and planted it loosely on the debris. Both men heaved against the river, then ducked low as the current pushed them through the top of the half-submerged tree. Red's shirt caught a branch, bending it sharply back. The shirt ripped, and the branch whipped back, catching Chapman squarely in the eye. He cried out at the stinging pain, dropping his pole as he pressed his hands to his face. Glass continued to stare backward as the current pushed both boats around the hill and toward the southern bank. Chapman stood on his knees in the bottom of their bull boat, face down with his palm still pressed to his eye. Red looked downstream, past Glass and his boat. Glass watched as a terrified look captured Red's face. Red dropped his pole, desperately reaching for his rifle. Glass spun around. 2 dozen teepees stood on the south bank of the Platte, less than 50 yards in front of them. A handful of children played near the water. They spotted the bull boats and erupted in screams. Glass watched as 2 braves by a campfire jumped to their feet. Red had been right, he realized, too late.
Arikara.
The current drove both boats directly toward the camp. Glass heard a shot as he watched the men in the camp grab weapons and rush toward the high banks along the river. Glass gave a final push with his pole and grabbed his gun. Red fired a shot, and an Indian tumbled down the bank.
"What's happening?"
yelled Chapman, struggling to see through his one clear eye. Red started to say something when he felt a burning sensation in his belly. He looked down and saw blood oozing from a hole in his shirt.
"Oh, shit, Chapman, I'm shot!"
He rose up in panic, ripping at his shirt to inspect the wound. 2 more shots hit simultaneously, pitching him backward. His legs hooked the gunwale as he fell, tipping the rim of the bull boat into the rushing flow of the river. Water spilled across the gunwale, and the boat flipped. Half-blind, Chapman found himself suddenly underwater. He felt the jarring chill of the river. For an instant, the wild rush seemed to slow, and Chapman struggled to process the lethal events surrounding him. Through his good eye, he saw Red's body floating downstream, his blood leaching into the river like black ink. He heard the watery echo of legs crashing toward him from the river's edge.
"They're coming for me."
He desperately needed to breathe, yet he knew with terrible certainty what waited on the surface. Finally, he could stand it no more. His head broke the surface, and he gasped to fill his lungs. He would never draw another breath. His eyes had not yet cleared, so Chapman never saw the swinging axe. Glass leveled his rifle on the nearest Arikara and fired. He watched in horror as several Arikara waded into the river, hacking at Chapman when his head broke the surface. Red's body floated forlornly downstream. Glass reached for Pig's rifle as he heard a wild cry. An enormous Indian hurled a spear from the shoreline. Glass ducked instinctively. The spear cleanly penetrated the side of the boat, burying its tip in the ribbing on the opposite side. Glass raised above the gunwale and fired, killing the big Indian on the shore. He saw a flash of motion and looked up on the bank. 3 Arikara stood in a deadly gauntlet, barely 20 yards away. they can't miss. He threw himself backward into the plat as their trio of shots exploded. For an instant, he tried to hold on to the rifle. Just as quickly, he let go. He dismissed the idea of trying to make his escape by swimming downstream. He was already numb from the icy water. Besides, the Arikara would find their mounts in a few minutes. Maybe they already had. A racing horse would easily outpace the meandering plat. His only chance was to stay submerged as long as possible and get to the opposite bank, quit the river between him and them, then hope to find cover. He kicked furiously and used both arms to propel himself. The channel ran deep in the middle of the river, deeper than a man's head. A sudden streak cut the water in front of him, and Glass realized it was an arrow. Bullets pierced the water, too, like mini torpedoes searching for him.
They can see me.
Glass struggled to go deeper below the surface, but already his chest constricted for lack of breath.
What's on the opposite bank?
He hadn't even managed to look before chaos erupted.
Must breathe.
He pushed himself toward the surface. His head cleared the water and he heard the quick staccato of shots. He grimaced as he drew a deep breath, expecting the crash of a ball against his skull. Musket balls and arrows splashed around him, but none hit. He scanned the north bank before diving back below the surface. What he saw gave him hope. The river ran for 40 yards or so along a sandbar. No cover there. If he climbed out, they would shoot him down. At the end of the sandbar, though, the water joined with a low grassy bank. It was his only chance. Glass dug deep and pulled hard against the water, the current aiding his stroke. He thought he could just make out the end of the sandbar through the murky water.
30 yards.
The musket balls and arrows stabbed at the water.
20 yards.
He veered toward the bank as his lungs screamed for air.
10 yards.
His feet hit the rocks of the bottom, but he stayed submerged, his desperation to breathe still less than his fear of the Arikara guns. When the water became too shallow to remain submerged, he stood up, sucking for air as he dove for the tall grass on the bank. He felt a sharp sting in the back of his leg and ignored it, scrambling into a thick stand of willows. From the temporary cover of the willows, he looked back. 4 riders coaxed their horses down the steep bank across the river. A half dozen Indians stood at the water's edge, pointing toward the willows. Something caught his eye farther upstream.
2 Arikara were dragging Chapman's body up the bank.
Glass turned to flee, the sharp pain shooting up his leg. He looked down to find an arrow protruding from his calf. It had not hit a bone. He reached down, wincing as he ripped the arrow backward in a single, swift motion. He threw it aside and crawled deeper into the willows. Glass's first lucky turn came in the form of an independent-minded filly, the first of the 4 horses to hit the water of the plat. Aggressive quirting goaded her into the shallows, but the animal balked when the bottom disappeared and she was forced to swim. She whinnied and thrashed her head, ignoring the hard rain as she turned stubbornly back to shore. The other 3 horses had their own reservations about cold water and were happy to follow the filly's lead. The balking animals bumped into each other, churning the plat and dumping 2 of their riders into the river. By the time the riders regained control and whipped their mounts back into the river, precious seconds had passed. Glass crashed through the willows, emerging suddenly at a sandy embankment. He scrambled to the top and looked down at a narrow back channel. Shaded from the sun during most of the day, the still water of the channel lay frozen, a thin dusting of snow on its icy surface. Across the channel, another steep embankment led to a thick mass of willows and trees.
There.
Glass slid down the slope and leapt onto the frozen surface of the channel. The thin layer of snow gave way to the ice beneath. His moccasins gained no traction, and he flipped backward, landing flat on his back. For an instant, he lay stunned, staring up at the fading light of the evening sky. He rolled to his side, shaking his head to clear it. He heard the whinny of a horse and pushed himself to his feet. Gingerly, this time, he picked his way across the narrow channel and clambered up the opposite bank. He heard the crash of horses behind him as he scrambled into the brush.
The 4 Arikara riders crested the embankment,
Peering down, even in the dim light, the tracks on the surface of the channel were clear. The lead rider kicked his pony. The pony hit the ice and fared no better than Glass. Worse, in fact, as the animal's flat hooves found nothing to grip. Its forelegs flailed spastically as it crashed to its side, crushing its rider's leg in the process. The rider cried out in pain. Heeding the clear lesson, the three other horsemen quickly dismounted, continuing their pursuit on foot. Glass's trail faded quickly in the thick brush across the back channel. It would have been obvious in daylight. In his desperate flight, Glass paid no heed to the branches he broke or even the footprints trailing behind him. But now there remained no more than a faint glow of the day. The shadows themselves had disappeared, dissolving into uniform darkness. Glass heard the scream of the downed rider behind him and stopped. There on the ice. He guessed there was 50 yards of brush between them. In the growing darkness, he realized the peril was not being seen, but being heard. A large cottonwood loomed beside him. He reached for a low branch and pulled himself up. The tree's main branches formed a broad crotch at a height of about 8 feet. Glass hunkered low, struggling to quiet his heaving chest. He reached down to his belt, relieved to touch the pommel of his knife, still secure in its scabbard. There, too, was the sac au feu, inside were his flint and steel, though his rifle lay on the bottom of the plat, his powder horn still hung around his neck. At least starting fires would pose no problems. The thought of fire made him suddenly aware of his sopping clothing and the bone-deep chill from the river. His body began to shiver uncontrollably, and he fought to keep still. A twig snapped. Glass peered into the clearing beneath him. A lanky warrior stood in the brush. His eyes scanned the clearing, searching the ground for sign of his quarry. He gripped a long trading musket and wore a hatchet on his belt. Glass held his breath as the Arikara stepped into the clearing. The warrior held his gun ready as he walked slowly toward the cottonwood. Even in the darkness, Glass could see clearly the white gleam of an elk-tooth necklace around his neck, the shiny brass of twin bracelets on his wrist. God, don't let him look up. His heart hammered with such force that it seemed his chest could not contain its beating. The Indian reached the base of the cottonwood and stopped. His head was no more than 10 feet below Glass. The brave studied the ground again, then the surrounding brush. Glass's first instinct was to hold perfectly still, hope that the warrior would pass. But as he stared down, he began to calculate the odds of another course, killing the Indian and taking his gun. Glass reached slowly for his knife. He felt its reassuring grip and began to slide it slowly from its sheath. Glass focused on the Indian's throat. A swift cut across the jugular would not only kill him, but also prevent him from crying out. With excruciating slowness, he raised his body, tensing for the pounce. Glass heard an urgent whisper from the edge of the clearing. He looked up to see a second warrior step out of the brush, a stout lance in his hand. Glass froze. He had moved from the relative concealment of the tree's crotch, poising himself to leap. From where he was now perched, only darkness concealed him from the two warriors hunting him. The Indian below him turned, shaking his head and pointing to the ground, then motioning toward the thick brush. He whispered something in response. The Indian with the lance walked up to the cottonwood. Time seemed suspended as Glass struggled to maintain his composure. Hold tight. Finally, the Indians settled on a course, and each disappeared into a separate gap in the brush. He didn't move from the cottonwood for more than 2 hours. He listened to the off-and-on sounds of his searchers as he plotted his next move. After an hour, one of the Arikara cut back through the clearing, apparently on his way toward the river. When Glass finally climbed down, his joints felt like they had frozen in place. His foot had fallen asleep, and it took several minutes before he could walk normally. He would survive the night, though Glass knew that the Ericara would return at dawn. He also knew that the brush would not conceal him or his tracks in the glaring light of day. He picked his way through the dark tangle, careful to stay parallel with the plat. Clouds blocked the light of the moon, though they also kept the temperature above freezing. He could not shake the chill of his wet clothing, but at least the constant motion kept his blood pumping hard. After 3 hours, he reached a small spring creek. It was perfect. He waded into the water, careful to leave a few telltale tracks pointing up the stream, away from the plat. He waded more than 100 yards up the creek until he found the right terrain, a rocky shoreline that would conceal his tracks. He picked a path out of the water and across the rocks, working his way toward a grove of stumpy trees. They were hawthorns, whose thorny branches made them favorites of nesting birds. Glass stopped, reaching for his knife. He cut a small, ragged patch from his red cotton shirt and stuck the cloth on one of the thorns.
They won't miss that.
He turned then, picking his way back across the rocks to the creek, careful not to leave a trace. He waded to the middle of the creek and began to work his way back down. The little creek meandered lazily across the plain before joining with the plat. Glass tripped repeatedly on the slippery rocks of the dark creek bed. The dousings kept him wet, and he tried not to think about the cold. He had no sensation in his feet by the time he reached the plat. He stood shivering in the knee-deep water, dreading what he had to do next. He peered across the river, trying to make out the contour of the opposite bank. There were willows and a few cottonwoods.
Don't make any tracks crawling out.
He waded into the river, his breaths coming shorter and shorter as the water rose up to his waist. Darkness concealed a shelf beneath the water. Glass stepped off and found himself suddenly submerged to his neck. Gasping at the shock of the icy water on his chest, he swam hard for the opposite bank. When he could stand again, he still stayed in the river, walking along the shoreline until he found a good spot to get out, a rocky jetty leading into willows. Glass worked his way carefully through the willows and the cottonwoods behind them, mindful of every step. He hoped that the Ericara would fall for his ruse up the spring creek. They certainly wouldn't expect him to come back across the plat. Still, he left nothing to chance. Glass was defenseless if they picked up his trail, so he did everything in his power not to leave one. A faint glow lit the eastern sky when he emerged from the cottonwoods. In the pre-dawn light, he saw the dark profile of a large plateau a mile or two away. The plateau ran parallel to the river as far as he could see. He could lose himself there, find a sheltered draw or cave to hide, build a fire, dry out, and get warm. When things settled down, he could return to the plat, continue his trek toward Fort Atkinson. Glass walked toward the looming plateau in the growing glow of the coming day. He thought about Chapman and Red and felt a sudden stab of guilt. He pushed it from his mind. No time for that now. 26. April 14th, 1824. Lieutenant Jonathan Jacobs raised his arm and barked out an order. Behind him, a column of 20 men and their mounts reined to a dusty halt. The lieutenant patted his horse's sweaty flank and reached for his canteen. He tried to affect nonchalance as he drew a long swig from the canteen. In truth, he hated any moment away from the relative safety of Fort Atkinson. He particularly hated this moment, when the galloping return of a scout could herald a wide variety of misfortunes. The Pawnee and a renegade band of Ericara had been raiding up and down the plat since the snow began melting. The lieutenant tried to check his imagination as he awaited the scout's report. The scout, a grizzled plainsman named Higgins, waited until he was practically on top of the column before he reined his own mount. The fringe on his leather jacket bounced as the big buckskin slid to a sideways halt.
"There's a man walking this way, up over the ridgeline."
"You mean an Indian?"
"Assume so, Lieutenant. D
didn't get close enough to find out. Lieutenant Jacobs' first instinct was to send Higgins back out with the sergeant and two men. Reluctantly, he came to the conclusion that he should go himself. As they neared the ridgeline, they left one man to hold the horses, while the rest of them crawled forward on their bellies. The wide valley of the Platte spread before them for 100 miles. Half a mile away, a solitary figure picked his way down the near bank of the river. Lieutenant Jacobs pulled a small looking glass from the breast pocket of his tunic. He extended the brass instrument to its full length and peered through. The magnified view bobbed up and down the riverbank as Jacobs steadied the scope. He found his target, holding on the buckskin-clad man. He couldn't make out the face, but he could see the bushy smudge of a beard.
"I'll be damned," said Lieutenant Jacobs with surprise. "It's a white man. What the hell is he doing out here?"
"He ain't one of ours," said Higgins. "All the deserters head straight for St. Louis."
Perhaps because the man appeared to be in no immediate danger, the lieutenant felt suddenly gripped by chivalry.
"Let's go get him."
Major Robert Constable represented, albeit not by choice, the fourth generation of constable men to pursue a career in the military. His great-grandfather fought the French and Indians as an officer of His Majesty's 12th Regiment of Foot. His grandfather stayed true to his family's vocation, if not to its king, fighting against the British as an officer of Washington's Continental Army. Constable's father had poor luck when it came to military glory, too young for the Revolution and too old for the War of 1812. Given no opportunity to win distinction of his own, he felt the least he could do was to offer up his only son. Young Robert had yearned to pursue a career in the law and dreamed of wearing the robes of a judge. Robert's father refused to stain the family lineage with a pettifogger and used a friendship with a senator to secure a spot for his son at West Point. So for 20 unremarkable years, Major Robert Constable inched his way up the military ladder. His wife had stopped trailing after him a decade earlier and now resided in Boston, in close proximity to her lover, a well-known judge. When General Atkinson and Colonel Leavenworth returned east for the winter, Major Constable inherited temporary command of the fort. Over what did he reign supreme? 300 infantrymen, equally divided between recent emigrants and recent convicts, 100 cavalrymen, with, in an unfortunate bit of asymmetry, only 50 horses, and 12 rusty cannons. Still, reign supreme he would, passing on the bitter brine of his career to the subjects of his tiny kingdom. Major Constable was sitting behind a large desk, flanked by an aide, when Lieutenant Jacobs presented the weather-beaten plainsman he had rescued.
"We found him on the Platte, sir," reported Jacobs breathlessly.
"He survived an Arikara attack on the North Fork."
Lieutenant Jacobs stood beaming in the bright light of his heroism, awaiting the certain accolades for his brave act. Major Constable barely looked at him before he said, "Dismissed?"
"Dismissed, sir."
"Dismissed." Lieutenant Jacobs continued to stand there, somewhat dumbfounded at this brusque reception. Constable put his command more bluntly.
"Go away."
He held his hand in the air and whisked it, as if shooing a gnat. Turning to Glass, he asked, "Who are you?"
"Hugh Glass."
His voice was as scarred as his face.
"And how is it that you found yourself wandering down the Platte River?" "I'm a messenger for the Rocky Mountain Fur Company."
If the arrival of a badly scarred white man had not piqued the major's jaded interest, mention of the Rocky Mountain Fur Company did. Fort Atkinson's future, not to mention the major's ability to salvage his own career, depended on the commercial viability of the fur trade. What other significance could be found in a wasteland of uninhabitable deserts and impassable peaks?
"From Fort Union?" "Fort Union's abandoned. Captain Henry moved to Lisa's old post on the Bighorn."
The major leaned forward in his chair. All winter, he had dutifully filed dispatches to St. Louis. None contained anything more compelling than bleak reports about dysentery among his men, or the dwindling number of cavalrymen in possession of a horse.
Now, he had something. Rescue of a Rocky Mountain man, the abandonment of Fort Union, a new fort on the Bighorn.
Tell the mess to send hot food for Mr. Glass. For an hour, the major peppered Glass with questions about Fort Union, the new fort on the Bighorn, the commercial viability of their venture. Glass carefully avoided a discussion of his own motivation for returning from the frontier. Finally, though, Glass asked a question of his own.
Did a man with a fishhook scar pass through here, coming down the Missouri?
Glass used his finger to trace a fishhook beginning at the corner of his mouth. Major Constable searched Glass's face. Finally, he said, "Pass through? No." Glass felt the sharp pang of disappointment. "He stayed on," said Constable. "Chose enlistment over incarceration after a brawl in our local saloon."
"He's here."
Glass fought to steady himself, to erase any emotion from his face. "I gather you know this man."
"I know him."
"Is he a deserter from the Rocky Mountain Fur Company?"
"He's a deserter from many things. He's also a thief."
"Now that's a very serious allegation." Constable felt the latent stirrings of his judicial ambitions.
"Allegation? I'm not here to register a complaint, Major. I'm here to settle my account with the man who robbed me."
Constable inhaled deeply, his chin rising slowly with the breath. He exhaled loudly, then spoke as if patiently lecturing a child. "This is not the wilderness, Mr. Glass, and I would advise you to keep your tone respectful. I am a major in the United States Army and the commanding officer of this fort. I take your charges seriously. I will ensure that they are properly investigated, and, of course, you'll have an opportunity to present your evidence."
"My evidence? He's got my rifle."
"Mr. Glass," Constable's irritation was growing, "if Private Fitzgerald has stolen your property, I will punish him in accordance with military law."
"This isn't very complicated, Major."
Glass could not keep the derision from his tone.
"Mr. Glass,"
Constable spit out the words. His pointless career on a godforsaken outpost provided daily tests of his ability to rationalize. He would not tolerate disrespect for his authority.
"This is the last time I'll warn you. It's my job to administer justice on this post."
Major Constable turned to an aide.
"Do you know the whereabouts of Private Fitzgerald?"
"He's with Company E, sir. They're out on a wood detail, coming back tonight."
"Arrest him when he arrives at the fort. Search his quarters for the rifle. If he has it, seize it. Bring the private to the courtroom tomorrow morning at 8. Mr. Glass, I expect you to be present. And clean yourself up before you do so."
A jury-rigged mess hall served as Major Constable's courtroom. Several soldiers carried Constable's desk from his office, then set it up on a makeshift riser. The elevated seat allowed Constable to survey the proceedings from an appropriately judicious altitude. Lest there be any question about the official sanction of his courtroom, Constable flew two flags behind the desk. If it lacked the splendor of a true courtroom, at least it was big. 100 spectators could pack the room when the tables were removed. To ensure an appropriate audience, Major Constable usually canceled other duties for all but a few of the fort's inhabitants. With little competition in the way of entertainment, the Major's official performances always played to a packed house. Interest in the current proceeding ran particularly high. Word of the scarred frontiersman and his wild accusations had spread quickly through the fort. From a bench near the Major's desk, Hugh Glass watched as the door of the mess hall burst open.
"Attention!"
The spectators rose to attention as Major Constable strode into the room. Constable was attended by a lieutenant named Neville K. Askitson, dubbed Lieutenant Askisser by the enlisted men. Constable paused to survey his audience before strolling regally to the front. As Kitson skittered behind him. Once seated, the major nodded to As Kitson, who gave an order permitting the spectators to sit.
"Bring forth the accused," ordered Major Constable. The doors opened again, and Fitzgerald appeared in the doorway, his hands in shackles and a guard at either arm. The audience squirmed for a glimpse as the guards led Fitzgerald to the front, where a sort of holding pen had been constructed perpendicular and to the right of the major's desk. The pen placed him directly across from Glass, who sat to the major's left. Glass's eyes bored into Fitzgerald like an auger in soft wood. Fitzgerald had cut his hair and shaved his beard. Navy blue wool replaced his buckskins. Glass felt revulsion at the sight of Fitzgerald, shrouded in the respectability that a uniform implied. It seemed unreal, suddenly, to be in his presence. He fought against the desire to rush at Fitzgerald, wrap his hands around the man's throat, choke the life out of him.
"I can't do that. Not here."
Their eyes met for a brief instant. Fitzgerald nodded, as if to politely acknowledge him. Major Constable cleared his throat and said,
"This martial court is hereby convened. Private Fitzgerald, it is your right to be confronted by your accuser and to hear formally the charges brought against you. Lieutenant, read the charges."
Lieutenant Askitson unfolded a piece of paper and read to the chamber in a stately voice.
"We hear today the complaint of Mr. Hugh Glass of the Rocky Mountain Fur Company against Private John Fitzgerald, United States Army, 6th Regiment, Company E. Mr. Glass alleges that Private Fitzgerald, while himself in the employ of the Rocky Mountain Fur Company, did steal from Mr. Glass a rifle, a knife, and other personal effects. If found guilty, Mr. Fitzgerald faces court-martial and imprisonment of 10 years.
A murmur rippled through the crowd. Major Constable banged a gavel against the desk, and the room fell silent.
"Will the complainant approach the bench?"
Confused, Glass looked up at the major, who gave an exasperated look before motioning him toward the desk. Lieutenant Askitson stood there with a Bible.
"Raise your right hand," he said to Glass. "Do you swear to tell the truth, so help you God?"
Glass nodded and said yes in the weak timbre that he hated but could not change.
"Mr. Glass, you heard the reading of the charges?" asked Constable.
"Yes."
"And are they accurate?"
"Yes."
"Do you wish to make a statement?"
Glass hesitated. The formality of the proceeding had taken him completely by surprise. Certainly, he had not expected 100 spectators. He understood that Constable commanded the fort, but this was a matter between him and Fitzgerald, not a spectacle for the amusement of an arrogant officer and 100 bored enlisted men.
"Mr. Glass, do you wish to address the court?"
"I told you yesterday what happened. Fitzgerald and a boy named Bridger were left to tend me after a grizzly attacked me on the Grand River. They abandoned me instead. I don't fault them for that. But they robbed me before they ran off. Took my rifle, my knife, even my flint and steel. They took from me the things I needed to have a chance on my own."
"Is this the rifle you claim is yours?"
The major produced the Anstalt from behind his desk.
"That's my rifle."
"Can you identify it by any distinguishing marks?"
Glass felt his face grow flush at the challenge.
Why am I the one being questioned?
He took a deep breath.
"The barrel is engraved with the name of the maker, J. Anstalt Kutzdown Pen."
The major pulled a pair of spectacles from his pocket and examined the barrel. He read aloud,
"J. Anstalt Kutzdown Pen."
Another murmur filled the room.
"Do you have anything further to say, Mr. Glass?"
Glass shook his head, no.
"You are dismissed."
Glass returned to his place across from Fitzgerald as the major continued.
"Lieutenant Askitson, swear in the defendant."
Askitson walked to Fitzgerald's pen.
The shackles on Fitzgerald's hands clanked as he placed his hand on the Bible. His strong voice filled the mess hall as he solemnly stated the oath. Major Constable rocked back in his chair.
Private Fitzgerald, you've heard the charges of Mr. Glass. How do you account for yourself?
Thank you for the opportunity to defend myself, Your Honor. I mean, Major Constable.
The major beamed at the slip as Fitzgerald continued.
You probably expect me to tell you that Hugh Glass is a liar, but I'm not going to do that, sir.
Constable leaned forward, curious. Glass's eyes narrowed as he too wondered what Fitzgerald was up to.
In fact, I know Hugh Glass to be a good man, respected by his peers in the Rocky Mountain Fur Company. I believe that Hugh Glass believes every word he said to be God's honest truth.
The problem, sir, is that he believes a whole bunch of things that never happened. Truth is, he'd been delirious for 2 days before we left him. Fever spiked up that last day, especially. Death sweats, we thought. He moaned and cried out. We could tell he was hurting. I felt bad. There wasn't more we could do.
What did you do for him?
Well, I'm no doctor, sir, but I did my best. I made up a poultice for his throat and for his back. I made a broth to try and feed him. Of course, his throat was so bad he couldn't swallow or talk.
This was too much for Glass. In the firmest voice he could muster, he said,
"Lying comes easy to you, Fitzgerald."
"Mr. Glass!"
roared Constable. His face twisted suddenly into a stiff knot of indignation.
"This is my proceeding. I will cross-examine the witness, and you will keep your mouth shut, or I'll hold you in contempt."
Constable let the weight of his pronouncement sink in before turning back to Fitzgerald.
"Go on, Private."
"I don't blame him for not knowing, sir."
Fitzgerald tossed Glass a pitiful glance.
"He was out, or feverish, most of the time we tended him."
"Well, that's all well and good, but do you deny that you abandoned him, robbed him?"
"Let me tell you what happened that morning, sir. We'd been camped for 4 days by a spring creek off the Grand. I left Bridger with Hugh and went down on the main river to hunt. Been gone most of the morning. About a mile from camp, I but stepped on an Arikara war party."
Another ripple of excitement passed through the spectators, most of them veterans of the dubious fight at the Arikara village.
"The Rees didn't see me at first, so I made my way back toward camp as quick as I could. They spotted me just about when I got to the creek. They came charging while I went running up to our camp. When I got there, I told Bridger that the Rees were right behind me, told him to help me get the camp ready to make a stand. That's when Bridger told me that Glass was dead."
"You bastard!"
Glass spat the words as he stood and moved toward Fitzgerald. Two soldiers with rifles and bayonets blocked his path.
"Mr. Glass!"
yelled Constable, beating a gavel on the table.
"You will hold your seat and hold your tongue, or I will have you jailed."
It took the major a moment to regain his composure. He paused to adjust the collar of his brass-buttoned jacket before returning to the interrogation of Fitzgerald.
"Obviously, Mr. Glass was not dead. Did you examine him?"
"I understand why Hugh's angry, sir. I shouldn't have taken Bridger's word, but when I looked at Glass that day, he was pale as a ghost, not moving a twitch. We could hear the Rees coming up the creek. Bridger started yelling that we had to get out of there. I was sure Glass was dead, so we ran for cover."
"But not before taking his rifle?"
"Bridger did that. He said it was stupid to leave a rifle and knife behind for the Rees. There wasn't time to argue about it."
"But you're the one with the rifle now."
"Yes, sir, I am. When we got back to Fort Union, Captain Henry didn't have the cash to pay us for staying back with Glass. Henry asked me to take the rifle as payment. Of course, Major,
I'm glad for the chance to give it back to Hugh.
What about his flint and steel?
We didn't take them, sir. I expect the Rees got that.
Why wouldn't they have killed Mr. Glass, lifted his scalp in the usual manner?
I imagine they thought he was dead, same as we did. No offense to Hugh, but there wasn't much scalp left to lift. The bear carved him up so bad, the Rees probably figured there wasn't no mutilating left to be done.
You've been on this post for 6 weeks, Private. Why haven't you unburdened yourself of this story before today? Fitzgerald allowed a carefully calibrated pause, bit at his lip, and hung his head. Finally, he raised his eyes, and then his head. In a quiet voice, he said,
"Well, sir, I guess I was ashamed."
Glass stared in utter disbelief. Not so much at Fitzgerald, from whom no treachery arrived completely unexpected, but more so at the Major, who had begun to nod along with Fitzgerald's story, like a rat to the piper's tune.
He believes him.
Fitzgerald continued,
"I didn't know before yesterday that Hugh Glass was alive. But I did think that I'd abandoned a man without so much as a decent burial. Man deserves that, even on the front."
Glass could bear it no longer. He reached beneath his capote for the pistol concealed at his belt. He pulled out the gun and fired. The ball strayed just wide of its mark, burying itself in Fitzgerald's shoulder. Glass heard Fitzgerald cry out, and at the same time felt strong arms grabbing him from both sides. He struggled to break their grip. Pandemonium erupted in the courtroom. He heard Esketson yell something, caught a flash of the Major and his golden epaulets. He felt a sharp pain at the back of his skull, and all went black. 27. April 28, 1824. Glass awoke in musty darkness with a throbbing headache. He lay face down on a rough-hewn floor. He rolled slowly to his side, bumping against a wall. Above his head, he saw light streaming through a narrow slot in a heavy door. Fort Atkinson's guardhouse consisted of a large holding pen for drunks and other common truants and two wooden cells. From what Glass could hear, three or four men occupied the pen outside his cell. The space seemed to shrink as he lay there, closing in like the sides of a casket. It reminded him suddenly of the dank hold of a ship, of the stifling life at sea that he had come to hate. Beads of sweat formed on his brow, and his breath came in short, sporadic spurts. He struggled to control himself, to replace the image of imprisonment with that of the open plain, a waving sea of grass, unbroken but for a mountain on a horizon far away. He measured the passage of days by the daily routine of the guardhouse. Change of guard at dawn, delivery of bread and water around noon, change of guard at dusk, then night. 2 weeks had passed when he heard the creak of the outside door opening and felt the suction of fresh air.
"Stay back, you stinking idiots, or I'll smash your skulls," said a smoky voice that walked deliberately toward his cell. Glass heard the jangling of keys, then the play of a key in the lock. A bolt turned, and his door swung open.
He squinted at the light. A sergeant with yellow chevrons and gray mutton chops stood in the doorway.
"Major Constable issued an order. You can go. Actually, you have to go. Off the post by noon tomorrow, or you'll be tried for stealing a pistol and for using it to poke a hole in Private Fitzgerald."
The light outside was blinding after 2 weeks in the dark cell. When someone said,
"Bonjour, Mr. Glass,"
it took Glass a minute to focus on the fat, bespeckled face of Kiowa Brazo.
"What are you doing here, Kiowa?" "On my way back from St. Louis with a keelboat of supplies." "You spring me loose?"
"Yes. I'm on good terms with Major Constable.
You, on the other hand, seem to have gotten yourself into a bit of trouble." "Only trouble is that my pistol didn't shoot straight."
"As I understand it, it wasn't your pistol. This, though,
I think belongs to you. Kiowa handed Glass a rifle, as Glass finally focused enough to see. The Anstalt. He gripped the gun at the wrist and the barrel, remembering the sturdy weight. He examined the trigger works, which were in need of fresh grease. Several new abrasions marred the dark stock, and Glass noticed a small bit of carving near the butt plate. J. F. Anger flooded over him.
What happened to Fitzgerald?
Major Constable is returning him to his duties.
No punishment?
He has to forfeit 2 months' pay.
2 months' pay?
Well, he's also got a hole in his shoulder, where there didn't used to be one. And you get your rifle back.
Kiowa stared at Glass, easily reading his face. In case you're getting any ideas, I'd avoid using the Anstalt on the premises of this fort. Major Constable fancies his judicial responsibilities, and he's eager to try you for attempted murder. He only relented because I convinced him you're a protégé of Monsieur Ashley.
They walked together across the parade ground. A flagpole stood there, its support ropes straining to hold firm against a stiff spring breeze. The flag itself snapped in the wind, its edges frayed by the constant beating. Kiowa turned to Glass.
You're thinking stupid thoughts, my friend.
Glass stopped and looked directly at the Frenchman. Kiowa said,
I'm sorry that you never had a proper rendezvous with Fitzgerald. But you should have figured out by now that things aren't always so tidy.
They stood there for a while, with no sound but the flapping of the flag.
It's not that simple, Kiowa. Of course it's not simple. Who said it was simple? But you know what? Lots of loose ends don't ever get tied up. Play the hand you're dealt. Move on.
Kiowa pressed on. Come with me to Fort Brazeau. If it works out, I'll bring you in as a partner.
Glass slowly shook his head.
That's a generous offer, Kiowa. But I don't think I could stay planted in one spot.
So what then? What's your plan?
I have a message to deliver to Ashley in St. Louis. From there, I don't know yet.
Glass paused a minute before adding,
And I still have business here.
Glass said nothing more. Kiowa, too, was silent for a long time. Finally, he said quietly,
Il ne paierait ce que celui qui ne veut pas entendre. Do you know what that means?
Glass shook his head.
It means there are none so deaf as those who will not hear. Why did you come to the frontier?
Demanded Kiowa.
To track down a common thief? To revel in a moment's revenge? I thought that there was more to you than that.
Still, Glass said nothing.
Finally, Kiowa said,
If you want to die in the guardhouse, that's for you to decide.
The Frenchman turned and walked across the parade ground. Glass hesitated a moment, then followed behind.
Let's go drink whiskey,
yelled Kiowa over his shoulder.
I want to hear about the powder and the plat.
Kiowa loaned Glass the money for a few supplies and a night's lodging at Fort Atkinson's equivalent of an inn, a row of pallets in the sutler's attic. Whiskey usually made Glass drowsy, but that night it did not. Nor did it clarify the jumble of thoughts in his head. He struggled to think clearly. What was the answer to Kiowa's question? Glass took the Anstalt and walked outside into the crisp air of the parade ground. The night was perfectly clear, with no moon, reserving the sky for a billion stars, piercing pinpricks of light. He climbed crude steps to the narrow palisade that circled the wall of the fort. The view from the top was commanding. Glass looked behind him into the confines of the fort. Across the parade ground lay the barracks.
He's there.
how many hundreds of miles had he traversed to find Fitzgerald? And now his quarry lay sleeping, a handful of steps away. He felt the cold metal of the Anstalt in his hand. How can I walk away now? He turned his back, looking across the ramparts of the fort toward the Missouri River. Stars danced on the dark water, their reflection like a marker of the heavens against the earth. Glass searched the sky for his beacons. He found the sloping tails of Ursa Major and Ursa Minor, the steady comfort of the North Star. Where's Orion? Where's the hunter with his vengeful sword? The brilliant sparkle of the great star Vega seemed suddenly to fight for Glass's attention. Next to Vega, he picked out the Cygnus, the swan. Glass stared at Cygnus, and the more he stared, the more its perpendicular lines seemed clearly to form a cross. The Northern Cross. That was the common name for Cygnus, he remembered. It seemed more fitting. He stood there on the high rampart for a long time that night, listening to the Missouri and staring at the stars. He wondered at the source of the waters, of the mighty bighorns, whose tops he had seen but never touched. He wondered at the stars and the heavens, comforted by their vastness against his own small place in the world. Finally, he climbed down from the ramparts and went inside, quickly finding the sleep that had eluded him before. 28. May 7th, 1824. Jim Bridger started to knock on Captain Henry's door, then stopped. It had been 7 days since anyone had seen the captain outside of his quarters. 7 days ago, when the Crow stole back the horses. Not even Murphy's successful return from a hunt could entice Henry from his seclusion. Bridger took a deep breath and knocked. He heard a rustling sound from inside, then silence. Captain? More silence. Bridger paused again, then pushed open the door. Henry sat hunched behind a desk made from two barrels and a plank. A wool blanket draped his shoulders in a fashion that reminded Bridger of an old man huddled over the stove at a general store. The captain held a quill in one hand and a piece of paper in the other. Bridger glanced at the paper. Long columns of numbers crowded the page from left to right, top to bottom. Blotches of ink spotted the text as if his quill had encountered frequent obstacles and stopped, spilling itself like blood onto the page. Wadded paper lay strewn across the desk and the floor. Bridger waited for the captain to say something, or at least to look up. For a long time, he didn't do either. Finally, the captain raised his head. He looked like he hadn't slept for days, his bloodshot eyes peering out above sagging gray bags. Bridger wondered if it was true what some of the men were saying, that Captain Henry had gone over the edge. You know anything about numbers, Bridger?
No, sir.
Me neither. Not much, anyway. In fact, I keep hoping that I've just been too stupid to make all this add up. The captain stared back down at the paper. Trouble is, I keep doing it over and over, and it keeps coming out the same way. I think the problem's not my math, it's just that it doesn't come out the way I want.
I don't know what you mean, Captain.
What I mean is that we're belly up. We're $30,000 in the hole without horses. We can't keep enough men in the field to get it back, and we got nothing left to trade for horses.
Murphy just came in with two packs from the Bighorns.
The captain absorbed the news through the thick filter of his own past. That's nothing, Jim. Two packs of fur won't put us back on our feet. 20 packs won't put us back on our feet. The conversation was not moving in the direction Jim had hoped. It had taken 2 weeks for him to raise the gumption to come see the captain. Now the whole thing was off track. He fought the instinct to retreat. No, not this time.
Murphy says you're sending some men over the mountains to look for Jed Smith.